James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hello and welcome to the second hour of today's Freeman Report. It is Monday, the 15th of April, 2024. I'm your host, James Freeman. And if you've just joined me, we've been asking if we really are on the edge of World War III. My guests in the first hour were former British military sniper turned journalist Warren Thornton and TNT host and former Lib Dem MP Lembit Opic. Did we come to any conclusions about what the hell's going on in the Middle East? Not really. I think it's very, very difficult. There's so many plates being spinned in the air. Obviously, we've got, you know, the proxy war in Ukraine with Russia. UK media doesn't really talk much about Russia in the context of the Middle East, but they are there and they've given the US some pretty stark warnings that if they intervene in between Israel and Iran, then Russia will not sit by idly. So it's a very, very complicated situation. For me, I think the question is this a strategic move by the US to attack Iran and have a war of attrition there, as well as in Ukraine? Or, as some are saying, and I think there's evidence for both sides, is this just the US being dragged in to a Middle East conflict by Israel in an election year where Biden is in a very uncomfortable situation of not being or finding it very difficult to criticize Israel because of the support he gets from the Israeli lobby in the US. So no conclusions, but some interesting insight and analysis. And if you have missed that first hour, it will be uploaded in the next couple of hours. Just head over to tntradio.live and click on the episodes button, and then you'll be able to listen back or view all of my previous shows. Right, so coming up in the next hour, I'll be discussing the global environmental movement and asking what is really going on. Why is so much of the West's focus on climate change, which is all based upon model data that many leading independent scientists say is flawed? All of this while governments and corporations continue to pollute the seas with plastic and dig up rare metals using toxic processes that spoil the land for thousands of years. I'll be discussing all of this with Craig Rucker, who is the president and co-founder of CFACT, an organization that aims to promote a positive alternative voice on development and environmental issues. And then in the second part of this hour, I will be once again, discussing the Middle East to see if we can get more conclusions on what is going on there. I'll be discussing the threats to American security coming from its southern border also. And my guests will be US Green Beret and combat veteran Joe Kent. Joe served in US Special Forces for 20 years before becoming a CIA operative and then a foreign policy advisor to the Trump administration. Joe is now running for Congress and says that he's focused on restoring common sense Republican values against the attack from the woke left. He was recently interviewed on Tucker Carlson on his network, and he's followed by a long list of freedom fighters globally. On his X account, he's got a post there pinned about a visit he made to the southern border, which he's saying he did because of all the fentanyl coming across that border, which is killing so many Americans. So what does he think is going on? Why is the Biden administration allowing all of these undocumented people to enter the country right at a time when America is at a heightened security risk? You know, when we saw the wider global sort of war on terror, America's borders were really, really secure. I mean, if you went into and you visited America, you'd get interrogated at the border and why you were visiting the country. We didn't see lots of people just walking across the border, or even now, the Biden administration is actually flying them in, hundreds of thousands of them, undocumented. So what the hell's going on? And how much of a security threat is this to America? I'll be talking about all of those things in the context of what is going on in the Middle East and Ukraine. But before we go over to our political editor, Basil Valentine, I want to talk about two much more positive things, two festivals that are coming up in the UK in May. The first is the Weekend Truth Festival that will bring all of your favourite freedom fighters to one stage across one weekend. It is the Weekend Truth Festival and will feature speakers such as Katie Hopkins, Kate Shemarani, Dolores Cahill, Matt Letizier, Mark Atwood, David Clues, Allegedly Dave, Sovereign Pete, and many others. And all of this will be across one weekend on the 3rd, 4th and 5th of May in Workington near the Lake District in the UK. And all you need to bring is yourself, a tent, a sleeping bag and some money and some good vibes. Don't forget the good vibes, as there'll be food stalls, workshops, bushcraft and amenities all provided on the site. Now, if you're interested in that, 3rd, 4th and 5th of May, for more information and to find out how you reserve your place at the festival, please visit weekendtruthfestival.co.uk. That's weekendtruthfestival.co.uk. But don't hang around because I was speaking with Kevin, who's helping to organise it, and there are only a limited number of tickets left. The second event, also happening in May, also in the Lake District, is coming up is a Stand in the Light UK Music Festival, which is taking place over the second bank holiday weekend in May and is being put on as a collaboration between A Stand in the Park and The Light newspaper. Now, the music festival will include 30 awake artists such as Danny Rampling, Mobius Loop, an all-night acoustic fire pit, Bouncy Castles, and Hope Sussex if you've got kids, plus loads of amazing stalls and scrumptious food vendors. It will take place in the beautiful Lake District on May the 24th until the 27th. You can get 4 days camping and full access to the whole festival for just £60, plus a booking fee, and brilliant news, children under 5 go free. And of course, Hope Sussex will be there to look after them, presumably, and keep them busy while you go off and watch the music. Now, if you want to get more information on that festival, then please visit standinthelight.uk. That's standinthelight.uk. What a great month May is promising to be if you like festivals. I'll keep my fingers crossed for the weather, though, because at the moment I don't fancy going camping, but it's still quite a few weeks away. I'm sure the sun will come out for those festivals. If you want to get in touch with me to suggest a guest or to give me some feedback on the show, then please email me at jamesfreeman@tntradio.live. And as always, if you want to join in the conversation, then head over to tntradio.live and click on the chat icon. My name is James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report for today's News Talk TNT.
Keeping the commitment 24/7.
I've been in the car all day and I got to listen.
Can't get enough of it.
You guys are doing a great job.
Today's News Talk Radio TNT.
Right. Well, I'm delighted to be joined by our political editor, Basil Valentine. What headlines have you got for me, Basil?
Good afternoon, James. Great to be with you, and hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world. Well, Rishi Sunak is underwater, not literally, some hope, but in terms of his popularity with Conservative Party members who are now more dissatisfied than ever with him. He has an overall approval rating of -27.7%, the second to worst amongst all members of the cabinet, beaten only by Michael Tomlinson, who has a -43.1% negative, you know, approval rating. Far and away the most popular Tory is Kemi Badenoch at +56.3%. So the whispering campaigns about possibly decapitating the Conservative Party and replacing Sunak with Badenoch, Johnny Mercer, Penny Mordaunt, one of these other apparatchiks, may well intensify over the summer, because if there's one thing the Tories are good at, James, it's self-preservation.
It is, isn't it? And of course, they were the most successful political, well, they are, I guess, the most successful political party in the world. I think they, you know, they ruled the UK for most of the last century. But all good things come to an end, Basil. Yeah, but all things.
I mean, the demise of the Conservative Party has been predicted before. I remember the high watermark of the Liberal SDP alliance in the early 1980s, which threatened to wipe out Thatcher at one point. She was saved by the Falklands, of course. It seems that one of the things that's really got the Tories hold below the waterline, if you'll pardon the upcoming pun, is the number of people travelling by small boat to seek asylum in the UK or just generally migrate. 534 people crossed the Channel yesterday alone, after 214 on Saturday. 6,000 have made the journey so far this year. More than 75,000 people have arrived in the 2 years since the Rwanda deal was originally signed. Sunak says he is not going to accept any more amendments from the House of Lords and is determined to drive the bill through. But it's going to cost the UK taxpayer about £1.8 million for each asylum seeker. Where does that figure come from? I mean, you can get a commercial flight down there for £700 or £800 or something, you know, add a few thousand on top for accommodation, which is obviously cheap in Rwanda. That's why they're sending them down there. Where on earth did they get 1.8 million from, James?
Someone in Rwanda's got to benefit from this, I guess. There's got to be money involved somewhere. Otherwise, why would Rwanda agree to it in the first place? You know, it's not a great prospect, is it? Send us those people you don't want coming here to the UK. Yeah, I mean, I've talked a lot on this show, actually, about it could be the weather that undo the Tories, actually, because if we do have a nice, calm summer, sunny days, nice, calm waters, I think it's quite clear that we're going to see thousands, tens of thousands of people coming across the Channel right just before the election. But I do wonder if, you know, I think someone like Badenoch would be a better prospect than Rishi Sunak. But have they left it too late? I mean, can they really just install? Because they haven't got time for an election now. So presumably any replacement for Sunak would have to be installed, which we then get back to all the arguments about the Tory party and, you know, and whether, you know, all the problems that they've got. I think they've left it too late. Do you think they could possibly change leader this late?
That would be a fourth prime minister since the last general election. I think anything's possible with the Conservative Party and its powers of self-preservation. At the moment, they're polling only about 5 points ahead of Reform, who threaten, if not to win many seats, then to torpedo a lot of marginal seats. I mean, the Conservative share of the vote has been collapsing all over the country in by-elections and local council by-elections. But so interestingly enough, when it comes to actually putting an X on a piece of paper, so has the Labour Party vote. Now, at the moment, Labour are projected to win a thumping great majority, really by default, because there's no enthusiasm for Keir Starmer as Prime Minister anywhere. He's expected to pick up a lot of disgruntled Conservative votes simply by stealing most of their clothes. I mean, they are both neoliberal, globalist, arch-Zionist, warmongering, you know, ultimately pro-immigration parties. The British people are crying out for some kind of meaningful alternative, James. Whether or not they get it remains to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, I think those on the right that are in some of the smaller parties actually want everyone. I think the realistic scenario, if indeed Labour do get that thumping majority, is that the Tories are wiped out. I don't think Reform are going to get anybody elected. I really don't think they are, because their votes are spread too thinly across the country. They don't really have any bases, which is their own fault, because, you know, they... Obviously, I was part of the Brexit party that, that won that European election, but we won it in a very, very extraordinary way. You don't normally win elections that way. What you need is boots on the ground. You need local infrastructure. You need members joining and helping you get that infrastructure locally. And Reform don't have that. I've seen estimates that even if they get 20% of the vote via analysts, that they won't get one seat. So I think there are people that are wise on the right side of politics that know that. And what we're actually hoping is that this creates a vacuum after this election on the right side of politics in the UK, which allows some kind of party to, whether that's the Conservative Party, to, you know, once it's smashed apart, to come back in a different form. Because I think one thing is certain at the moment, it doesn't matter which party you talk about, we don't have a real Conservative Party in the UK, do we?
Well, you hit upon a very interesting statistic there, James. 20% of the popular vote, possibly for Reform, but not a single MP. I mean, what an, you know, egregious condemnation that is of our first-past-the-post system. It fails to represent the opinion of the British people. Yeah, I mean, you've got the English Democrats, the Heritage Party, of course, David Curtin, our colleague. Reform's problem is that they're hopelessly underfunded. They haven't got any money at all. And unless a big backer steps out of the...
I don't know that that's the problem, Basil. I think actually there's something more fundamental, a problem with Reform, and that is the fact that they are a just a limited company. So they don't have members. And I think the problem with that is that when you only have supporters, you don't have people that vote on things that feel they're part of a movement. And this is why Reform, if it doesn't get any anybody elected, is why, because it doesn't have that local infrastructure. We did try and create that for the Welsh elections back in 2021, which I stood in for Reform. But after the election, everything just falls apart again. And then this seems to be a recurring theme with Reform, that come an election, they scrabble around, they get lots of new people that nobody has ever heard of, lots of, you know, fresh faces, but they haven't got that infrastructure. And after the election, it all just falls apart again. And I think until they get that, which I think is based upon getting members that actually feel like they've got a stake in the party rather than just supporters, which are not a member of anything, I think until Reform does that, I think they're going to find it very difficult to build that infrastructure.
Yes, they're asking the media to help them vet their candidates. So many have emerged in recent months that they can't possibly trawl through all the historic tweets looking for things that stray off the reservation, which Richard Tice in particular is very concerned about, because, you know, any racism or anything will reflect very badly on the party. And I've no doubt there will be some well-meaning and others less so well-meaning trawling through the social media feeds of anybody daring to stand on their behalf looking for something that they can be condemned for. And we could well see a sort of drip, drip, slow release, death by a thousand tweets of Reform over the course of an election campaign, with a sort of daily revelation. Look at this horror, and now look at that one. Systematically taken down, as it were. The same, of course, could apply to the Workers' Party as well, because the interests of the UK national security state and the wealthiest sector of British society is very well served by the two-party system. They don't want any change. The other thing that Reform have got against them a bit is the demographic of their supporters is largely older people. You know, the vast majority of their support from people aged 45, 50 plus. And older people are less inclined to go out knocking on doors, canvassing, less inclined to even feel that they're part of a movement or anything. So, yeah, I fully take your point. Reform have got big on-the-ground problems with mobilizing their troops.
They have, and you know, and also, and we've got to go in a second because otherwise we're going to take up the whole show. And I could talk about this for the whole show, by the way, Basil. But the other problem they've got is the fact that they always, because they try and aim to get the full 650 MPs, because it means they can be included in debates, that kind of thing. It does ultimately mean that they end up with people who are really wet behind the ears. They've got no political experience whatsoever. Even well-meaning candidates can end up being dragged and you know, enticed into saying things which they really shouldn't be saying. So it's a very, very difficult position to be in.
Well, there are lots of political novices used to turn into parties like Reform. That's the thing. People who speak off the cuff and speak their mind. And, you know, good, bad or indifferent, that's not really the way politics works anymore. You have to be a Starmeroid, you know, a sort of robotic repeater of the party line. Otherwise, you can get shot down in flames. One last little vignette. Liz Truss has confirmed she wants to see Donald Trump win the US presidential election and has not ruled out entirely the possibility of running for leader of the Conservative Party again.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure she would get a second chance, but hey, I think Nigel Farage, probably he's obviously been talked about in terms of potentially joining the Conservatives, because he might go off to America later for the US presidential elections instead of leading the Reform Party. So who knows what's going to happen, but I don't think Liz Truss is going to win any leadership election. I think she had her day. Right, Basil, I've got to move on. Thank you so much for that. The fantastic Basil Valentine, ladies and gentlemen. Right, okay, let's move on. We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, I'll be talking to Craig Rooker, who is president and co-founder of CFAT. We'll be talking about the climate and a lot of other things, the border in the US as well. So don't go anywhere. Stay put right where you are, right here on TNT.
TNT's Alex Zaharoff-Royd.
I saw the information that you shared about the app that endometriosis can take years to diagnose. But why is this, and how does the app help make this diagnosis much faster and more accurate?
The time frame from the first onset of symptoms until somebody actually realizes that there's a problem, that's remained fixed at 3 years. So all of our advances have been from when they first present to a GP until a diagnosis has been made. But those first 3 years have not been able to be shifted. And that's really where something like Charlie comes in. Because it's all about telling someone that what you're experiencing is actually quite abnormal.
Talking Tech with Alex Zaharoff-Royd on today's News Talk, TNT.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
Without CO2, the world stops breathing. CO2 sustains all life on Earth. Government, the WEF, and the elite believe humans are the carbon they really want to be rid of. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Right, we're actually going to talk about something different than the Middle East or UK politics just for a few minutes. And I'm delighted to be joined by Craig Rooker, who is president and co-founder of CFAT. Welcome to the Freeman Report, Craig.
Thanks for having me on, James. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here. Now, Craig, you co-produced the 2016 award-winning film Climate Hustle, which went to number one in the US for a brief period. Tell us what the film was about. It was back in 2016, so a fair bit of time has moved on since. So tell us about the film and where you think we are right now in terms of climate politics in the US.
Yeah, well, our movie that we put out in 2016 was a number one movie for One Night in America. We beat out My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 and Batman Brilliant. Superman. So granted, the competition wasn't that stiff, but we did do it. We also did a Climate Hustle 2 movie in 2020 with Kevin Sorbo, the Hollywood actor that also did well, but unfortunately came out in the midst of COVID. Essentially, what we did is we interviewed about 30-some scientists. These are people from MIT, from Harvard, Georgia Tech. And we wanted to point out to them that, in fact, there is no real climate consensus, despite what the public's being told. Scientists do agree that maybe the Earth has warmed over the last 100-plus years, but a good many of them believe that this is within the range of natural variability. It's not human-driven. Certainly, there are epochs in the Earth's history that are much warmer, such as the medieval warm period back when the Vikings were around, or even in the Roman times. And that's self-evidently true, because when these glaciers melt on these mountains, for example, they find forests that were there 1,000 years ago, or they find Roman roads that are underneath them, indicating that these, they were glacier-free back a long time ago. So anyway, that's the type of stuff we wanted to point out, because I think a lot of people are wondering why we're hearing all this climate madness. And of course, it's being used in England. We just had your former prime minister there, Boris, say that we need a conservative solution to climate change, but certainly on the political left as well. In this mad rush for a Green New Deal, for getting rid of our EVs, for putting in offshore wind, for changing our lives, eating insects. Where's this all coming from? It's coming from what we say is very shoddy science.
Yes, it certainly is. I mean, I would say that the UK is probably, there's more people here that probably buy into this climate hoax than in the US, because I think I've seen a few polls in the US, and I don't think a lot of Americans actually believe what is going on. Now, obviously, your film came out in 2016. As I said in the introduction, quite a lot's moved on since then. We've had President Trump, who took America out of the Paris Accord. And, you know, the politics in America have been very different around this. What are your thoughts on the American public? Do you think that they buy into all of this climate nonsense, even if Joe Biden is pushing it at the moment?
No, I don't think they are. There are certainly those on the political left, and maybe some in the middle that do. But if you look at the polling, those of us on the right, by and large, are climate, what we call realists. They like to call us skeptics or deniers. But I don't think that that's going to be a major issue. It's always ranked very lowly in the United States in terms of being a political priority compared to the economy, compared to immigration, compared to abortion and other issues. And this is a good thing. However, the Democrats make it a number one priority. In fact, Biden, when he came into office, said this is not the number two or three. Climate is number one priority, and has invested tons of money in this. In fact, the entire Inflation Reduction Act that he put through is putting out countless billions of dollars toward green energy projects around the country, including a climate corps of young kids, young climate cadets, 50,000 strong. He wants to make them, trying to phase out our electric vehicles by the year 2035. These are all things that are part and parcel and will be very prominent in the upcoming election, because on the progressive side, the liberal democratic side, these issues are what hold them together.
Yeah, and I've talked quite a bit about inflation in the US and the US economy more widely over the past couple of weeks with many guests from the US. And it's interesting that the Biden is pushing this as an inflation reduction plan, because I think lots of people are arguing actually that one of the reasons we're seeing this sticky inflation is because the Biden administration has stopped oil exploration. How much of that is a debate at the moment in the US? Because the price of gas has gone up, and a large part of this is due to the fact that Biden is not giving out the licenses to actually explore for new oil in America.
That's correct. Now, he'll say that there's a lot already in existence and America's pumping out more than before, but these are vestiges or remnants of what Trump did in the previous administration. And he has done nothing to increase the exploration. He's choked off a lot of our federal lands from oil exploration. We have seen a dramatic increase in gas prices, but electricity is even more where we're seeing it. Since Biden has come into power back in 2020, electricity rates in the United States have gone up almost 30%. And these are directly tied to the retirement of our coal facilities, our oil facilities, even nuclear facilities, which is odd given that climate change people should be for nuclear because it has no emissions. And the construction instead of offshore wind, solar projects, which are much more expensive. In fact, if you look at countries such as Denmark, which rely heavily on renewables, you see prices go up double, quadruple. They pay about 38 cents a kilowatt hour. We in America are used to 10 to 12 cents a kilowatt hour, but we're catching up to countries like Denmark because of the fact we're gutting our fossil fuel infrastructure and going solar and wind.
And what about American sentiment on what is going on in China and India? Because we hear this a lot in the UK, actually. And I guess the argument in the UK is, look, even if we reduce our emissions by X percent and we go net zero, it's going to have absolutely no impact on global emissions. This is if you buy into this whole argument about CO2, by the way, but a lot of people do. What do Americans think about their government telling them that they've got to reduce emissions, they've got to stop exploring for gas and oil, whilst China and India just seem to be building loads more coal power stations?
You know, you raise an excellent point. I do think a lot of people are starting to support President Trump because of that. His energy policy certainly had lower prices and things of that sort. And he pointed out that what China was doing. If I were somebody that couldn't sleep at night because I was worried that, you know, Greta Thunberg might be right and the world will end in just a few years, or AOC says it will by 2030, I would be very concerned about what China is now the world's leading emitter of carbon dioxide, which personally, I don't think is a huge deal. There's other things that they do that are worse than that. But if you're a greenhouse person, they have 27% of the world's greenhouse gases. America's only 11%. We dropped. And the reason we did is we changed our fleet, not to solar and wind, but we went to natural gas and hydro and nuclear and things of that sort that are lower emissions. And, meanwhile, China's just complete. They have online now as many coal-fired plants as the U.S. currently has in its capacity. They're planning to construct that many between now and the year 2030. So they are going full bore on their coal fleet, and you hear nothing from the environmental groups. It's like see no evil, hear no evil, and they don't really much care, much less the dirty conditions, the lack of pollution control, and even the use of slave labor, like the Uyghur labor of the Muslims over there to construct a lot of their fleet.
And do you think, I'm going to move on in a second because we've heard news that Tesla is laying off a third of its workforce. I'd like to get your view on what you think Americans' views are of EVs at the moment. And I've forgotten what I was going to ask you then. So let's move on to that. It'll come back to me in a minute. EVs. Obviously, there's a, you know, if Tesla is laying off 30% of its workforce, something is going on. Is this being driven by the American economy and a lack of demand, or, you know, and maybe cheap imports from China, or are American consumers saying, actually, do you know what, this technology, we don't want it, we don't want EVs? What's going on there?
You know, it's an excellent question. You have different people saying different things. I do think that this whole EV thing is driven by subsidies. So a lot of it just depends on who's getting what. But I think that it is also a resistance on the part of consumers. We had a bunch of ownerships, dealerships in America petition the White House just a couple months ago saying that they cannot meet this electric mandate of about, 67% or something around that area that the Biden administration wants to get in by 2032. And they're not anywhere headed that way. I can honestly ask you, I just go with the man on the street type thing. I just bought about a week ago a Chevy Equinox. That goes for about between $35,000 and $40,000 here. I asked the guy who was handling this because if I got an electric one of these vehicles, it would be almost $70,000 to get the same car that I just purchased last week as a electric vehicle. It's not quite double, but pretty darn close to double the cost. I asked him, how many electric vehicles are you selling? He kind of chuckled and said, not many. He said, in fact, there's only been one on our lot that I'm aware of that we've sold in the last 3 months. So that can't be a good thing. And so I think it's a combination. They're not getting the, you know, the types of subsidies they need to keep yeah. this thing going. And they are consumers just, I mean, put yourself in my, why would I pay for something that is limited to a 200-mile range, takes me a half hour to fill, you know, to do it if I can find a refueling station. So I think the combination of factors is not boding well for this.
Yeah, of course. And then, of course, the batteries only last around sort of 8 to 10 years at the moment. So it just doesn't make sense, does it? So it's actually could be consumer trends which undo all of this nonsense rather than any kind of government targets or anything. I've remembered what I was going to ask you, Craig. I was going to talk about Trump. If he gets in, do you think he's just going to take America out of the Paris Accord again?
I hope he does. I mean, to me, it's a complete joke, the Paris Accord. I cannot believe that we're back in it. You know, this is one of these accords where many countries really have no commitments that they have to abide by, except for the West. Nations like Britain, yeah. nations like the U.S., we have to abide, and we do all the heavy lifting on these things. But then you have countries that are in there, like in the Middle East, and this is where they're holding their UN climate summits every year. They've had the last one in Egypt. The last one was in Dubai. Before that was Egypt. Next year's Azerbaijan. These are all oil-producing countries that are hosting the UN climate meeting, and they don't have to do squat diddly to actually meet their needs. They're willing to host these meetings because there's no real ramifications to them of keeping any of this. But the United States, we actually try to keep it, and it's driving prices up and hurting our economy as it is in Britain.
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, Craig, I think the irony of those meetings, those climate meetings, is all of the Middle East countries were using them as meetings to do oil deals. So that kind of, I think, says everything you need to know about these climate meetings. Craig, thank you so much for coming on the Freeman Report. Craig Rooker, ladies and gentlemen, you'll have to come back on at some point. Right. Okay, we're going to take a short break now, and then we are back to the Middle East. I'm absolutely dying to get the reaction and insight from my next guest. He is Joe Kent. He's a former Green Beret and combat veteran, and he's now running for Congress. So I want to hear what he has to say about what is going on in the Middle East at the moment. So don't go anywhere. Stay right where you are, right here on TNT.
TNTRadio.live.
The station, the first to broadcast.
Breaking news.
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. Israeli President Isaac Herzog characterized Iran's recent strike on Israel as essentially a declaration of war from Iran. On the evening of April 13, 2024, a tragic knife attack at the Westfield Center in Bondi Junction, Sydney, resulted in 6 fatalities and several injuries. Iran has issued a stark warning to Israel and the United States following its direct missile and drone strike on Israel, which occurred late Saturday.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Right. Well, we're going to be talking about two topics. And I think for me, that there is a theme running through them, and that is American security. We're going to start off by talking about the Middle East and what's going on there with these attacks by Iran on Israel, and also, of course, the attacks that just kicked it off from Israel itself. But at the same time as all this is going on, we've obviously got hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of undocumented people coming across the southern border into the US. And lots of people are saying this is a real security risk for the US at a time when America's overall kind of heightened sense of security globally is at a very, very high level. So I'm absolutely delighted to be welcoming Joe Kent. He's a former US Green Beret and combat veteran, and he's now running for Congress. Welcome to the Freeman Report, Joe.
Thanks for having me. Great to see you.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. Let's start with the Middle East. I'm not going to ask you any specific questions. I'm just going to ask you for what your assessment is overall in terms of what's going on there at the moment.
Look, this was all incredibly avoidable, tragically. Joe Biden, when he came into office, he undid essentially the Abraham Accords and the deterrence and containment that we had under President Trump of the Iranian regime. Look, Iran's been at war with America and the West since 1979. Any opportunity that Iran gets to get extra funding, they fund their proxies conduct terrorist attacks. President Trump put that in check with the Abraham Accords. That's where he brought the Israelis and the Gulf Sunni Arabs into an alliance against a common enemy, the Iranians. The second Biden came in, he gave Iran access to billions of dollars, and billions of dollars not just in raw cash, but also billions of dollars through the government of Iraq, which funds the proxies that attack our troops. So once Iran got a hold of these, their whole goal was to put the Israel-Palestine conflict back in the center stage, because that would make every single Gulf Arab country have to de facto either stay out of the alliance or essentially join the Iranian side. So they funded and directed the October 7th attack. And ever since then, Biden has had this insane objective of essentially funding both sides of this conflict. We continue to support Israel, which I obviously support, but then he also gives the Iranians access to billions of dollars. And now we have Iranian proxies that are hyper-enabled throughout the region, disrupting international shipping. And then recently we just saw what happened this last weekend, which I'm sure we'll get into. But that's the state of play right now. All of this is incredibly preventable if we attack the way that Iran gets access to capital and cut off their ability to fund their proxies.
And what is the justification from the Biden administration for relaxing these sanctions and actually giving Iran all of this money? What is the justification for that?
There's still this failed school of thought. It's a hangover from the Obama administration. Biden brought in a lot of the national security folks from the Obama administration who have this theory that if we just extend our hand to the Iranians and we treat them like they are, you know, just any other country in the world, that they will act like any other country in the world. And they've proven time and time again that that's just not possible. If we allow the Iranians to trade their natural gas, their oil on the market, they're going to take the proceeds from that. They're going to fund their proxies throughout the region. This is just what they've done over and over again. And the Biden administration has this crazy policy of doing the exact opposite of whatever the Trump administration does. And unfortunately, you've got some people here that are true believers. They really think that if we just give Iran enough, eventually they're going to come into the fold. And there's just no data to really support that hypothesis.
And how much of this do you think is down to Israel as well? Because I think, you know, this recent escalation, if we can call it that, really stems, doesn't it, from the Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria. How much do you think this is a case of keeping Israel in check as well?
I mean, look, the Biden administration, like I said, they've pursued this insane policy where they're going to fund the Iranians, we're going to give the Israelis some support, but then they're going to attempt to put guardrails on the Israelis. We're attempting to adjudicate the war that Israel's fighting, brutal combat, you know, house to house, and we have the Biden administration trying to put constraints on how Israel goes about that. And so, look, Israel had to defend itself. The Iranians, Quds Force operatives, they're special operators. They use embassies, they use consulates, especially in Damascus. The Assad regime supports them. So I personally think that the Israelis had no other choice but to strike out against these Quds Force operatives and take them off the battlefield. Now we've seen the Iranians in this strike they did over the weekend. I think the Iranians are going to claim that they, you know, scored some sort of a victory because they're claiming they penetrated the Iron Dome. But however, what the Iranians did was they put the conversation all back on Israel versus Iran, whereas the conversation before that had been about what was happening in Gaza. I think that the Hamas and the Iranians were actually winning the information war prior to this weekend. They took this swing, they missed, they showed the world that the Israelis are under attack from all sides. And now I think public sentiment is turning back towards supporting Israel against the Iranians. So I think this is a blunder on the part of the Iranians.
Yeah, but I mean, how much also, I mean, Israel, look, we've seen over 30,000 civilians killed now from Israeli bombs, US bombs supplied to Israel military aid. We've also now got, we're hearing reports of over 1 million people being starved to death by Israel. surely Israeli behavior is at the center of all of this. I mean, we've seen outrage across the Middle East and across a lot of countries, across the West as well, about what Israel is doing. Is Israel not just bringing this whole escalation on itself?
Israel was put in a very difficult position. They suffered an attack like we've never seen here before. I mean, they had 1,500 of their civilians killed in the most brutal way. There are still hostages, to include American hostages, being held. Basically, the Israelis had no other choice but to go in and go in hard and heavy to ensure this didn't happen. Now, that was part of the Iranian calculus. They knew that the Israelis would have to react like this and put this issue of Israel versus Palestine back in the forefront. And look, you should always do as much as you possibly can to mitigate civilian casualties. But look, the Israelis are in a hard spot. What if they stop right now, then Hamas can claim victory. They can recoup and they can recover. I think that the faster they go in there, the faster the Israelis go in and the harder they go in, this will actually be brought to a conclusion faster and in the long run, save more civilian lives. But from an American perspective, the last thing I want us doing is attempting to play a referee in this conflict that's going to be, it's just going to be incredibly brutal. And I don't think we are in the business of having to constrain the Israelis and how they defend themselves.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on, you know, the Biden's approach with Iran and funding and funding both sides of this. Not sure I totally agree with you on Israel, but we are a free speech platform. So I think we'll move on from that one. We're going to take a quick break now, Joe. And when we come back, I'd like to hear your view on what's going on in the southern border. You've obviously spoken about that a lot on X, the drugs coming across the border, fentanyl and the like. And of course, most of the people coming across are undocumented. So I'd like to hear what you think in terms of the security threat to America at a time when all of this is going on around the world. So don't go anywhere, Joe. Stay right where you are, right here on TNT.
When I had my heart event close to 4 years ago, I was at the gym, thought I deserve a coffee, and thought I'll top up with fuel, ordered a coffee. But while I was pumping fuel, I started to get chest pains. Then it got worse and worse and worse. So then I was leaning on the counter thinking, yeah, something's not quite right. So then I went to wait for the coffee and that's when it really, really hit. And Joy just, you know, mouthed, do you need an ambulance? And I remember nodding. I wasn't even thinking about a heart attack. I just thought something is seriously wrong with me here. So when the cardiologist came to see me, she informed me that I'd had what they call a widowmaker heart attack. Bit of a shock when someone says, you know, you nearly died. Everybody should be aware of all the symptoms of a heart attack that women can have that aren't typical of the shoulder pain, the right arm pain. I go to the gym, I do yoga, Pilates, I swim, I go on bike rides, and yet I still had a heart attack. You just don't know, it could be you.
What do I love about riding? It's the thrill. The excitement. Riding gives me a sense of freedom. I feel so connected to the road. Riding is like therapy to me. It makes me feel alive. Love riding? Back off.
You're with James Freeman and the Freeman Report on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right. Now, Joe, as I said before the break, we've got hundreds of thousands of people, undocumented, many of them coming across the border. The Biden administration, in order to fix that, is now saying that it's going to fly them directly into the US for processing. What's going on? Because I'm really confused. I think a lot of us are in terms of what's going on in the US. You know, at a time when the US is clearly involved in lots of wars around the world, you'd think that it would secure its borders because a lot of the people coming in are coming from countries which are not exactly on friendly relations with the US. What's going on?
So the Biden administration has opened up our border and they are actually facilitating a controlled invasion of our nation. And the Democrats are doing this for a very simple and cold-blooded reason. It's a power play. They want to import as many people as they can, put them in major urban centers. So the next time there's a census, we simply count their heads, and based off that head count, we establish new legislative seats at the state and at the federal level. And then the Democrats can simply just ballot harvest their way to more control and to more power. President Trump attempted through executive action to make it so that we only count U.S. citizens during a census. However, that was quickly reversed when Biden came in, and now we're pumping in all these people. The Democrats just view the carnage that comes in their wake in terms of crime, the criminals that are coming in, like the killer of Lake and Riley that we saw, and then also the fentanyl as collateral damage. They're willing to accept this death and this carnage that's being inflicted upon the American people simply to get more bodies into these urban centers so that they can essentially create new seats and get more power.
But isn't Trump, I mean, if he wins the election this year, and at the moment, unless things change, it looks like he's going to win, isn't he just going to reverse that?
Yes, he is. I believe he's going to actually finish the wall and enact some of the probably strictest immigration policies that we've ever seen. But we've had 12 million illegals that we think. Honestly, I've been down to the border twice, and I think we have no idea who's coming into our country, quite honestly. I don't think we have a good number. 12 million is the rough estimate since Biden took office. It's going to be very challenging to actually run down and deport these people. I think we still must make every effort to do so, cut off their ability to earn a living here. I think a lot of the economic migrants will simply self-deport if they lose the opportunity. But we've got a lot of bad actors that have infiltrated our country. So President Trump coming in and actually reversing a lot of this will just be the first step. But there's going to be a lot of hard work ahead.
But I was more kind of getting at this kind of counting of people in the US and then obviously the number of seats in an election being worked, calculated based upon the number of people in those areas. Is that down to the federal states in terms of those laws, how people are counted, or is that the federal government that does that? And do you think if it is the federal government, will Trump just reverse that?
Yeah, the census is done by the federal government. So the federal government has control of that. Trump could reverse that. Now, obviously, if he has a divided House and he has a divided Senate, then it's going to be reversed immediately once he's out of office. And once these people are in the country, it's very challenging to get them out. And there's also a lot of mechanisms with motor voter, where you're registered to vote when you receive a driver's license without verifying that you're a citizen, that a lot of these people will be able to get access to ballots in these next elections as they come into the country. Many of them won't even have to wait until the next census to be counted in that headcount. And a lot of these folks are being given illegal status. That's why when you look at the scenes from the southern border, you see the illegal immigrants that are coming out, and they're not running and hiding from the Border Patrol. They're seeking out the Border Patrol so they can claim asylum, and then they're paroled into the United States, and they're given illegal status, essentially. It becomes a de facto visa and a pathway to citizenship for them.
And how big a threat do you think the terrorist threat is? Because that's what a lot of analysts are talking about, that America is on the edge of another big attack on its homeland. This is a huge risk for the Democrats, isn't it?
It is. But at the end of the day, the Democrats have one goal in mind, and that's to pump as many people as they possibly can into the country. I think they view everything else as simply collateral damage, because if there is a terrorist attack, that's going to give the national security state more of a reason to actually crack down on American citizens, like we saw with the Patriot Act, like we're seeing this today right now with the debate over FISA and whether or not the federal government needs to get a warrant to actually spy on American citizens. So I think, again, the Democrats are playing a very deadly but a cold and calculated game. But to answer your question, look, we've had 12 million illegals come into our country. We have no idea who these people are. I guarantee you there's members of every single hostile foreign government. There's members of every single terrorist organization that have infiltrated the country and are just waiting for the right time to carry out a horrific terrorist attack. I mean, October 7th, we just talked about, that was conducted by just a handful of people. We've had 12 million come into our country. 9/11 brought our country essentially to its knees temporarily, and that was conducted by a small handful of individuals. Again, we've had 12 million. This is absolute insanity and completely unsustainable.
I guess the only question I can think of when we're talking about this, because it's just absolutely crazy what is going on in America, is why more people are not voting or saying they're going to vote for Trump, as Biden is incredibly unpopular. Why is this just a case of who you hate most? Because a lot of Americans, obviously America is polarized between the Trump and the Biden camp. Why aren't more Americans saying we've had enough of this, do you think?
Well, I do think there is a heavy polarization, but I think there's also the silent Trump voter, which doesn't answer polls, isn't making it public as to who they're voting for. I think we're going to see a lot of people who maybe didn't vote for President Trump in 2020 just because of how chaotic things were during the COVID era. But then also, I think you're going to get a lot of people who just haven't participated in elections as much before, who are being crushed by inflation, who are seeing the effects of the wide open southern border, the fentanyl epidemic, who are going to come out. And again, these people aren't reached heavily by pollsters. So I think President Trump, when he talks about his policies, he is much more moderate and in step with what the American people want than anything coming out of the Democrat Party.
And what do you think is the biggest threat to Trump winning? Obviously, we've got this Stormy Daniels case, which is going on at the moment. What's the biggest obstacle, do you think, to him winning the presidential elections this year?
The continued lawfare. I think, you know, the Stormy Daniels, that's just the tip of the iceberg. He's got four, you know, federal prosecutors right now that are going after him of everything they possibly can. This is going to attrit him of a lot of resources. He needs to reach those voters that we just discussed. So I think, yeah, the lawfare is the biggest issue.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me on the Freeman Report, Joe. Joe Kent, ladies and gentlemen, good luck with your race for Congress. And I hope America sorts itself out, Joe, because it is in a bit of a mess at the moment.
Absolutely.
Right, okay. That's all from me today. I'll be back tomorrow, but we've got more great shows coming up for you right here on TNT.